Why is there so much suffering? And how can God be a good God if this is so? Because we see in this book, God's story, we see a whole lot of suffering. And we ask questions like, well, wait a minute, God is a sovereign God. What's happening here? What's happening here? Now, I've used this before, and I'd like to use this one more time. And those who already know what I'm going to say, you can browse through your bulletin or something if you don't want to hear it again. But we have to start with Genesis 1, 2, and 3 when we think of suffering. We have to start with Genesis 1, 2, and 3. So Genesis 1 and 2 talk about God's creation, and it emphasizes it is good and it is very good. That's where it starts. Now Genesis 3 brings the problem. Genesis 3 brings the great problem. And that is the separation and the independence from God. And in that, immediately there's suffering and there's shame. And there's death. And there is actually immediate death there. Because, see, Satan sort of tried, he did tell him, there is not going to be no death. Surely you won't die. There's not going to be no death. And he's telling him, a life that isn't the full life. Because the complete and full life is in the perfect and complete dependence and in the perfect will of God. That's where life happens. See, and here's what Adam and Eve did, and here's what the rest of us done since then. They were in complete rest with God, in perfect rest with God. And they had perfect union with God. And they walked with him in the garden, and they conversed with him. And there was no separation. And they rested completely on him. Their dependence was fully on him. There was no other dependence. The moment they went against what he had commanded, they basically said, I'm going to separate and declare my independence from him. Now, there's nothing wrong with this chair. I'm just not resting in it anymore. The chair is still perfectly good. But I've declared my independence from the chair. And that's what they did with God. They declared their independence from the chair, and they could no longer rest with him. It's like you're having an umbrella, and I know we're in the wintertime, but there will be summertime again. You have an umbrella, it's pouring rain, you leave the umbrella in the car, and you run across the parking lot. You've declared your independence from the umbrella, and so you will be wet. See, look, Colossians 1:16 says this: For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And as before all things, and in him all things hold together. So things were created by him, for him, through him, and they're held together by him. That's where complete life is. Now, I'm using, just so you know, I'm using ESV. I didn't let Michelle know, and so I should have checked to see if there was an ESV on their computer, but it should be similar. But life was complete and fully. The only place there's real life is when you're under the canopy and in the perfect will of God. And it's like unplugging something and then complaining and it's not working anymore. See, there was death immediately. Death happened. And from then on, we have the consequences. And from then on, we have the story. But here's the thing. Why can't God just deal with this problem of suffering and pain that happens? Because outside of him, there isn't that complete life. There is the breathing. There's still resemblance of life. C.S. Lewis calls it the shadow land, but the real life is completely in him. But why can't God deal with this suffering? See, and we want to just, okay, God, why can't you just change this again? And we heard last Sunday of a holy God. See, God can't be holy, and he can't be just, and he can't be righteous if he says, well, come rest fully on me again. Because that means that sin and a holy God mix together. And it doesn't happen. See, I guess what I'm trying to bring across, first of all, is things are not the way they should be. And because of that, there's pain, and because of that, there's suffering. You know, when you're in the medical field, the pain is usually a symptom of something deeper. But the people who are in the pain say, just deal with the symptom. Don't worry about whatever the root of the pain is. Deal with the symptom right now if you're right in the pain. And it seems like medical people are so intrigued by pain. They're asking all these questions about pain. Is it throbbing? Is it coming and going? If you scale of 1 to 10, how are you going to rate it? If I push on here, well, that kind of thing. Does it hurt more? And you say yes and stop pushing on that. That kind of thing. They're so intrigued by pain because it's simply the symptom to reveal something deeper. And see, that's what God did. God did deal immediately with what was happening. He told them immediately, here's the plan. But the symptom's going to remain. The symptom's going to remain. Hey, Zachary. The symptom still remains until it's come to completion. Till it comes to completion, we're going to have the symptom of what happened. The symptom of being separated. He dealt with the root. He dealt with the real issue, and the real issue was being separated from him. And what he immediately gave Adam and Eve was, this is what's happened. These are the consequences. This is the road I'm taking to change this again. This is not going to stay there. But meanwhile, we're struggling with this. Meanwhile, we're struggling with the pain and the suffering. And see, that's what Peter writes in 1 Peter. That's what the early church was struggling with. Why is there suffering and pain when we've come to know Christ? Shouldn't there be less suffering and pain? Shouldn't there be something where it seems that we're released from this? Just a question for the high school students. Who's gone through the history of Rome? Nobody's going, there's one. You're brave, Tyson. I might ask you a question directly. No, okay, I won't ask it. Who knows what July 1964 AD stands for? July 1964 AD. That's the time when Rome started fire. Fire in Rome started in July 1964, and Rome burnt down. And the thinking was that Nero did it himself so that he could rebuild Rome and have a great name of how he rebuilt Rome. And whenever it looked like it was going out, it got relit. But Nero realized that people were looking at him like he's a crazy man. And so he needed to blame somebody else. And so he pointed the finger to Christians. See, up until now, the persecution had come from the Jews, not from the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire simply saw Christians as another sect of the Jews and just a small, weird people of the Jews. And they were fine with that. But now he said, okay, you know, it's the Jewish or the Christians that are doing this. So let's get the Christians. And that's the generally accepted that 1 Peter was written at exactly this time, during the burning of Rome. And the persecution of the Christian church was really starting to take hold. And so they're struggling, saying, what is going on? And so Peter's writing, he says in 1 Peter 1:1, he says, to those who are the elect exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. He's saying, okay, he's directing it to real people, a real place, at a real time. See, sometimes when it's in such a distant future, we can separate ourselves from what was going on. We can separate ourselves from the pain these people really must have felt. This is a very new concept that they're accepting. And some of them have already been persecuted by family members or the synagogue or the leaders of their culture. Now the whole country is turning against them. So this would have been very real. So when I read my family history and I see of my great-grandmother who lost 3-4 children, I can remove myself from that because it was such a distant time. But that doesn't mean the pain was any less real. And so that's what Peter's addressing here. A church who's in turmoil because they didn't realize this was coming. They weren't realizing this was coming. And I find it so neat. I find it so interesting that it was Peter that was talking about suffering. But we'll first go into what he writes to the church. We'll go to 1 Peter 2, 18 to 25. This will be our main text that we'll be using today. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is the gracious thing, when mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if, when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if, when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to do this, you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that he might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of the soul. And I'm just, when I read Peter, and I'm amazed, and I've mentioned this before, bear with me, I'm still always amazed, the Peter that writes this and the Peter of the Gospels. I'm so intrigued by it. Who was the Peter of the Gospels? The Lord spoke about the cross, about dying. He said, no, they're never going to die. This isn't happening. We're going to prevent the cross. And the Lord said, get behind me, Satan. And Peter boldly said, you know what? Doesn't matter what these fools are doing. I'm following you to death. Doesn't matter. I'm there with you all the way. If you're going to die, I'm going to die. They came for Christ. He jumps up and starts swinging his sword to prevent this. And again, he gets rebuked by the Lord. See, this is the Peter we know in the gospel, but this is a Peter that writes these words. What happened here? See, now, let's turn to Luke 22, 31, 32. Because there's something interesting here. And Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you've turned again, strengthen your brothers. Who's speaking here? This is Christ speaking. This is the Christ who was able to raise the dead. This is the Christ who was able to make the blind see, the lame walk, the deaf hear. This is the Christ who commanded and the wind was still. And now his very best friend, he has some information of his very best friend. Now the sifting of wheat is these big bowls and they get thrown up in the air and they get landed again and they get shaken and they get thrown up in the air. And it is a violent thing to sift wheat by hand like that. And his response is, I'm going to pray for you, Peter. Now I would have said, Christ, please do more than that. Why don't you just stop the Satan from doing that? But he doesn't even say, I'm going to pray that you might not go through this. He says, I'm going to pray for you that when you're through this and you've come back, that you'll be at a place to strengthen your brothers. And that's what Peter does now. That's what Peter does later on in his life. That's what he's doing in these letters. He's strengthening his brothers and sisters who are getting sifted like wheat, just like he had been. You know, there's another interesting one in Luke 6:48 where we see something of Christ that we wouldn't really expect. I think maybe I've given you the wrong verse. Let's turn to Luke 6. In Luke 6, when they were in the middle of a storm, I have it here and I've given the wrong reference, but let me just give this reference. Or let me just read this verse that I typed out properly, but I put the wrong reference, and I apologize for that. But it says, the disciples were in the middle of a storm, and it says they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, this is Jesus, Jesus came to them, walking on the sea, and it says he meant to pass them by. He meant to pass them by. According to Luke, I believe it will be Luke, I'll have to look up the reference, but according to the disciples, they're struggling, and they're hurting, and they've been hurting for a long time. This is the fourth watch of the night, and Jesus is walking across the water that they're fighting so much on, and they see him walking in, and it says he meant to pass them by. He was going to leave them in their struggle, and he was going to continue on the way until they called on him, and he came on the boat. But he meant to pass them by. That's something interesting that we see in Christ, and we have to wonder, why would he do that? Why wouldn't he have been almost more kind to his best friends? Why wouldn't he have protected them a little bit better? But I believe there's these kind of experiences, and there's other experiences, that started shaping Peter into having another vision, to having another direction of seeing things. Because right until the very last thing they asked him before he went to heaven in Acts, they said, are you now going to restore Israel? They're still waiting for him to restore Israel, still waiting for him to correct the symptom. They wanted him to correct the symptom, and they weren't seeing, and they didn't hear him say, I'm from another kingdom, I'm building a different kingdom than this here. If this was my kingdom, all this suffering wouldn't happen anymore. He told Pontius. And nothing's happening here except what the Father's allowing. And in my kingdom, the angels are coming down and doing what needs to be done. But I'm from another kingdom. And they hadn't heard that yet. They hadn't grasped that message yet. And that's, when you look at Peter, when you look at Peter, you'll see two strong themes in his book. It is about suffering, and it is also about being a sojourner, a traveler through a foreign land. A traveler who's heading to another place, another kingdom. Now, when you hear the word kingdom, don't just think of a physical place. Think of a king that is reigning somewhere. Think of the kingdom, not just the physical place, but where the king is reigning on this. And he's saying, Peter's talking about two things a lot in his writings. Suffering and being travelers from another kingdom and moving through this land. Moving through this kingdom for another kingdom. So let's look at 1 Peter 2, 18 to 25. First of all, 18 and 19, we see some key words there. Because we'll see a kingdom thinking that isn't from this kingdom. And that's one of the keys about suffering in this kingdom. He talks about being mindful of God. For this is the gracious thing, when mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. When mindful of God. When we're mindful of God who's still at work. When we're mindful of a God who has not left us. When we're mindful of a God who has addressed the root of the problem. Even though we'd love him to address the symptom of the problem. And at times he does. But we'd love for him to just do away with the symptom of the problem, but he's addressing the root issues, our separation from him. And so Peter's saying, when we're mindful of God, endure suffering, one who endures suffering while unjustly. Then he says, you know, what is your credit? For when you sin, you're beaten for it. There's no credit to you when you deserve it. If I'm coming into La Crete and I'm doing 100 until a stop sign and the police policeman nails me for doing 100 on a 70-kilometer zone, I'm not being persecuted because I'm a Christian. I'm being persecuted because I just chose to ignore and do what I wanted to do. And so that's what Peter's saying. You know, if you do what you want to do, if you're going to sin and you suffer, I'm not talking about that kind of suffering. There's another suffering that will happen. See, and then we continue on verse 21. This is a key verse that we have. For to this you've been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so you might follow in his footsteps. Now, what is this, for to this you have been called? Well, the sentence just before it says, but when you do good and suffer for it, endure this is a gracious thing in the sight of the God. Now, it's Peter saying, you've been called to suffer while you're doing good. Man, that's a bad evangelistic message to give. That's not a good altar call to have. I mean, the altar call that we want to have is, if you want your life better, come to know Christ. That's the altar call that we can respond to. But Peter's saying here, you've been called to endure for good things. It's a gracious thing in the sight of the Lord. And that's a difficult thing to receive. See, here's the question I have with this verse, and I struggled through this verse. And I have to tell you, even last night, I really wanted to do another message. I had some other messages that I really wanted to do. But here's the thing I struggle with this verse. Suffering was necessary for Christ. We know that. Suffering was necessary so that we could come back to rest in God. Suffering was necessary for Christ so that we could come into the fellowship and communion with God. We heard that last week with Russell. So suffering was necessary for Christ, but is suffering necessary for us? It seems that that's what Peter is telling us. Is suffering necessary for us? Romans 8:17. There's one word here that caught my attention when I was looking at this. Now, I'm not sure if it'll have the... I'll read the ESV. And if children, then heirs of God and fellow heirs of Christ, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. He's saying, provided that we suffer with him. What are we going to do with those kind of verses? What's happening with these kind of verses? 1 Corinthians 1:7. Sorry, 2 Corinthians 1:7. Our hope for you is unshaken, for we know that as you share in our sufferings, you will also share in our comfort. So again, here's Paul talking about sharing in the suffering. In Romans, he's saying, provided that you suffer with him, that you may also be glorified in him. So the question remains, and this is a difficult question that we actually don't even want to ask. We know suffering was necessary for Christ. Is it necessary for us? Is suffering necessary for us? We'll leave that question for a bit. We'll move on. We'll move on to verse 22. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. So there's no reason for him to suffer in what he had done. The only reason for him to suffer was for our purpose. For our purpose, he needed to suffer. Not for what he had done, but for our purpose, so we could come back into the rest of God. He needed to suffer. We can come back into another kingdom that we had stepped out of. He needed to suffer. Then we see how he behaved during this suffering. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he didn't threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He didn't respond the way our flesh wants to respond. You know, just the other day, I was in a public place, and I felt verbally attacked by somebody that I hadn't seen for quite a while. Man, in my heart, I was saying a lot of things. I think it was purely because of upbringing my mom gave me that not to make a scene in public that I didn't respond that way. But I responded in my heart, in a way that wasn't Christ-like at all. I responded in a way that I wanted to attack and defend and make sure he got hurt more, because that's what I felt I was being attacked. But we see his response wasn't in that way at all. Even though there was no reason for him to go through this except for us, he had done nothing to deserve this, he received it. He received it without going against and defending. And that's something that, when we look at, and the title of this lesson is Modeling in Suffering, that's something that would be so, because he says after that, we need to follow in his footsteps. We need to follow in the footsteps of how he had done it. But he says, but we see why he didn't respond. What's the end of that verse? Continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He continued never taking his focus off the one who was leading him. He continued never to focus on the circumstance right now. He continued to focus on his Father. Not only focus on him, but can put his trust in him again and again and again. No matter what was happening around him, he continued entrusting on him who was going to judge justly. So the circumstances weren't going to dictate his behavior. Where he was looking dictated his behavior. He was looking to his Father and continued to do that. Where he was putting his trust dictated his behavior. He entrusted his Father. Let me continue on. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. Now again, Russell talked about this a lot last Sunday, and I just want to focus on this last part of this verse. By his wounds you have been healed. And I always struggle with that. This is coming from Isaiah, but I always struggle with by his wounds he was healed, because there seems to be so many wounds that are still out there and that they haven't been healed. It seems that it's not quite true, this verse. But again, we have to, if we just look at the symptoms, then yes, it's very difficult to understand this. But the wound that was healed was a separation from us and God. The tearing away from God and us. That gaping wound that was left when we left the one who gave life was healed. See, that the root problem was healed. The root issue had been healed. And so by his wounds, we have been healed. Now, there might be still a lot of symptoms left over, but the healing has happened because we can now rest fully in God again. Then he finished, "For you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd, an overseer of your souls." You're straying like sheep. So we are back under the cover of the shepherd. We're back under the protection of the shepherd. We're back where we can fully rest in him again, even in the midst of suffering. And in fact, James writes it, and Peter writes it as well, in the midst of suffering, we can even rejoice. Not about the suffering, but in the suffering, we can still rejoice. Because we're back under the covering of suffering. Now, I just want to read briefly. There's not a lot of books that I found that I really talk about suffering. I want to read briefly from a book called Simple Spirituality. And he talks about brokenness and suffering. First of all, he says brokenness is different from woundedness. Woundedness is the impact of the pain shared by humanity. Brokenness is different. A voluntary surrender to God's will over our own will. Woundedness is reactive, largely determined by how we respond to the difficult or painful or suffering that we have. Brokenness is open even to the grace and pain. Brokenness is proactive. Then he continues on to say these some interesting things. God's brokenness creates wholeness. And I believe this is why James and Peter could write, "Rejoice in the suffering." Because they understand this actually brings wholeness. Because this brings us to a deeper, intimate relationship where we understand Christ in a better way. We understand, we share in his suffering. When we share in something like that, we understand and we can more fully depend on him. So it says, God's brokenness creates wholeness. God is breaking those things in us that are twisted and wrong, destructive and sinful. Once broken, those things are then redeemed and restored to be used in their fullness for the glory of the kingdom of God. Then he says something about chemistry. There's a concept in chemistry called limiting capacity. An 8-ounce cup can only hold 8 ounces of liquid. That is the limiting capacity. If the bottom of the 8-ounce cup is broken off, however, the limiting capacity is no longer a factor. The cup is capable of having the entire ocean poured through it. This concept of limiting capacity applies similarly to people who are not yet broken by God. God's boundless and limitless love can be given to us and through us as long as our posture is that of brokenness. This spirituality of brokenness is evident in the temptations of Christ, where we see him embrace his broken identity. So he's saying, in our brokenness, God can more fully flow through us. And suffering will bring brokenness. Let me read another thought from another writer. He says, a few months ago, I sat with a good friend who had just learned of his son's terminal diagnosis. He wept and said, I'd do anything to give my life for him. It was one of the most powerless feelings I've ever experienced. All we could do was sit together and weep. He did not choose this. In moments like these, we feel ground to dust. Rather than stand and proclaim that we can handle it, we should imitate Jesus. The night before Jesus was executed, he cried out in the garden, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Jesus told his father, this is too much for me. We see this kind of thing in Psalms as well. The psalmists ball their fists in rage and shout to God, why have you forsaken me? In Psalm 22. Or their sadness, they say, darkness is my closest friend. In Psalms 88. What these verses teach us is that it's okay to feel like we can't handle it. Like we're going to give up. We can cry out, my soul is overwhelmed to the point of death. And when we do this, we find God. The one who in the person of Jesus suffered with us. When we become aware that life will give us more than we can handle, we find the promise. God is faithful to meet us in the mess and in the pain. So both these writers are talking about being broken before the Lord and not trying to pretend we're not broken. In our brokenness, we have a deeper dependency on him. And in our brokenness, he flows deeper through us. So I ask the question, is it necessary to suffer? Is it necessary to suffer? The answer is, it's not necessary to suffer for salvation. See, some people have this belief that they need to suffer for salvation. It's not necessary to suffer for salvation. That part was done. But it just might be necessary to suffer to live out Christ in another kingdom. See, this is another kingdom. This is not our kingdom here. Peter talks about it again and again. We have another kingdom. But the kingdom we're in, the kingdom we're traveling through, is broken. And we suffer in this broken kingdom. But while we suffer in this broken kingdom, we get a clearer picture of the kingdom to come. We get a clearer picture of our King. And we get a clearer picture of his work through us. See, one of the most amazing things when I sit with people, and they're in the middle of suffering, and they say, but there was a holy moment in this point. And there's times when I've been on the ambulance service, and I come to a drastic crisis, but yet it seems like you're stepping into a holy moment where the Lord is more real than he ever was before. And he was revealing something of his work. He's revealing something of him that we would never see except in our brokenness. We'd never have that kind of dependency had we not suffered. And it's saying, Peter's telling the church, imitate the one who suffered for you. And then that you'll reveal another kingdom, because you're traveling through this kingdom. And when you reveal another kingdom, you're going to give hope to those who haven't seen this other kingdom. And so it just might be necessary you're suffering in this kingdom to reveal another kingdom and to reveal another king. And in that we have hope. And even during those times, when it seems like it makes no sense, we can still rejoice because he already suffered for us. So what we do is we point to the kingdom to come, that is to come, and the kingdom that is here now. So I guess I want to say that there is hope, like the reading was. There is hope when everything's going right, but the hope might become even more real when things aren't going right and when there's suffering. So entrust in the one who will act justly. Entrust in the one who acts justly. And have hope in him. Amen.